They may call it the Big Apple, but in fact, New York, New York should really be called the Big Oyster.
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned in to the 486th edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Brisbane who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. But whoever you are, wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Ricochet and producers Carol Stafford and Molly Chudikoff. Folks, it's always fun to take a look back and see how history was shaped by food. Today we're in for a lot of fun because we're going to take a look back at New York City and see how its history was shaped by oysters. Here to lead the way, we have Mark Krulansky, who's the author of The Big Oyster, a book I have just finished reading and had a lot of fun with. Mark, welcome to the Food Chain.
Nice talking to you.
So you've authored cod and salt and now The Big Oyster. You've got a thing for food, don't you?
Well, you know, I guess I do because even in my fiction, food keeps turning up.
But not only food, but how food has helped shape history. All of your books really focus on that element, do they not?
Yeah, it's always been just a really interesting thing to me. How food shapes culture and economy and politics, and just how important it becomes to life, and how really underrepresented food is in history.
And with respect to the story of the day, which of course is oysters, where did you come to the notion that oysters were so intimately connected with New York City? I mean, when did the apple fall on your head, as it were?
Well, actually, the New York Times asked me to write an article about it for their city section.
Mm-hmm.
And as often happens to me when I write for newspapers, I was very frustrated because it just seemed way too big to fit in a newspaper.
The story just kind of takes over and runs with you, right?
Yeah, I mean, I just very quickly realized that this was the entire history of New York City. And like a lot of people in New York, I hadn't really ever reflected on how important oysters were to the city. If I had been a 19th century New Yorker, I would have known that in an instant.
In an instant, yeah. Well, you know, I was just telling you about how I had quite a bit of experience running around the streets of Manhattan. And my experience were, you know, on the street you saw a lot of hot dogs and pretzel vendors, but never an oyster vendor. But such was not always the case. And in fact, though it might be difficult for most of us to imagine, Manhattan Island was once a kind of a Garden of Eden. And, you know, when those first Europeans showed up, they really found kind of a paradise there, did they not, Mark?
Yeah, and it was interesting that all of the early accounts mentioned the sweetness of the air, what a sweet-smelling place it was. And it had wild fruit trees, and it had mountain lions and lynx and fox. It had trout streams and ponds. And
this is Manhattan
this
Island.
Is Manhattan. Yeah, yeah.
Oh.
And the waters were incredible. I mean, even today, the Hudson River has over 200 species of fish. All sorts of things live in the Hudson that you wouldn't expect, like seahorses and even a few tropical species of fish, and both salt and freshwater. Although New Yorkers never think of it this way, the area that New York's five boroughs is on is the estuary of the Hudson River, complete with, you know, grassy wetlands and tidal basins. And under all of this were oyster beds. There were oyster beds absolutely everywhere in the Hudson and the East River, upper harbor, the lower harbor, around Staten Island, around Brooklyn, just every bit of coastline.
And it's hard for us who have never really experienced what an oyster bed is, but these were not just oyster beds. This was oyster paradise, right? I mean, these were, 250 square miles of oysters?
Yeah. I mean, it was huge. And the oysters themselves, of course, were huge because, you know, commercially, oysters are harvested after 3 years. But if you don't harvest them, they keep growing.
They keep growing.
One account said that they were the size of a lady's hand. But the most disturbing account was William Thackeray, the British novelist, said that it was like eating a baby.
Oh, my God.
Which is one of the least appetizing food descriptions I've ever heard.
Well, and you know, when one is not accustomed to oysters or having grown up around them, they're not the most appetizing-looking critters either. I remember my first oyster was one I consumed live on live radio, and I was doing a program with an oyster vendor at a farmer's market, and he just brought one over and said, "Here, Michael, do it." And I did it. And
were you shocked?
Yes.
Nothing else.
I fell in love with it, just like that.
It's nothing that tastes like an oyster. It's just this fresh, wild taste of the sea.
Just boom. It's just so, how do you describe it? Has anybody come up with it? Surely you found somebody who's come up with a good description of eating a fresh, live oyster.
Well, I think the best description is Eleanor Clark said that it tastes like eating the sea.
Eating the sea. It is that. It's just there's something wild and free and clean and refreshing and
unlike
stimulating.
Any other food. And of course, you know, it is live. It's always live.
Yeah, and that's what, you know, is kind of hard to realize is that when they shuck an oyster, that, you know, if the oyster's shell is closed, right, it's alive.
Right. And a lot of people think that the shucking of them kills them. But a 19th century scientist said, you know, that's like hamstringing a cattle and thinking they're dead.
Right.
You know, all he's done is cut a muscle.
So let's look back to the original inhabitants or the inhabitants of Manhattan Island when the European people first showed up. I guess it was actually the Dutch that showed up first.
Right.
Who did they find there?
Well, they found huge piles of oyster shells.
Right. And Dutch, of course, were great oyster eaters too, right? So they took that as a favorable sign here.
Right. I mean, they were not only oyster eaters, but oyster cultivators. And, you know, oysters are very big in Holland. This was in the 1600s, in the time of, the golden age of Dutch still life painting. And you look in the still lifes and you see that they very often have oysters in them.
So the Dutch sailed into New York Harbor, and the first thing they saw was giant piles of oyster shells.
Well, the first thing they saw was Lenni Lenape people, which are sometimes called the Delaware, people that lived between the Delaware River and the Hudson River, which was called the North River, and the Connecticut River, which was called the Fresh River. And they immediately turned out to trade, and one of the local products that they offered to trade was oysters.
Having a zillion of them.
But there's something that's really kind of right about how New York City's, you know, opening day with commerce.
Right. And setting the tone for the things to come in the future, then, no doubt. How did the Lenape eat their oysters? Did they eat them raw in the half shell?
Well, it's kind of a mystery because these piles of shells are generally not broken. They're whole shells. And yet nobody has come up with any pre-European tools that was capable of opening an oyster.
Right, exactly. I mean, those of us who have opened an oyster, you need a sharp knife, you need, you know.
Yeah, you need a thin blade.
Thin blade, yeah.
And these were not people who had metal tools. And it is guessed that they may have opened them by heating
them. Huh.
And roasting oysters was a traditional way of eating oysters in New York City throughout its history.
Like chestnuts roasting on an open fire, we have oysters roasting on an open fire.
Yeah, well, remember, it's still around a little, but it used to be in the wintertime, there were lots of these guys that had these wood and charcoal burning wagons that roasted chestnuts.
Right.
And they used to have a similar wagon, and it would roast oysters.
Well, how does the Lenape, you know, you go in great depth about what the Lenape Indians look like to the Europeans who are moving in. What did the Europeans look like to the Lenape Indians?
Well, they call them the salty people.
The salty people. Why
salty?
Yeah,
we're not exactly sure why, but they thought they were very decorated, you know. They had these very colorful coats they wore, and these huge, very decorative ships, and they had seen them before a few times. I mean, before Henry Hudson came, there had been a few other Europeans that had been there, Verrazano and a few others, and, you know, nothing had ever happened. Nothing really bad had ever happened when they came.
Just started commerce, right? Started trading.
Yeah, well, you know, the ones that came before Hudson didn't stay very long. They did a few little trade transactions and they took off. So, you know, so they thought the Lenape means the people, you know, and the people thought the salty people were okay. You know, they just want to show up, trade a few things, and leave.
And leave.
But then this bunch showed up and didn't leave.
And we're going to take a quick break. Folks, this is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We are having some fun today looking back in history. We're looking at the history of New York City as it was shaped by the oyster. Perhaps New York City should not have been called the Big Apple. Perhaps it should have been called the Big Oyster. Or at least if you read Mark Zelansky's book, The Big Oyster, that's what you'd come to think. This is the Food Chain. Michael Olson, do stay tuned. We'll be right back. Hey, we're back. Michael Olson here. This is the Food Chain. We're talking with Mark Zelansky, author of The Big Oyster. We're talking about New York City and the oysters that used to inhabit the great New York Harbor. Mark, what was it, about 235 square miles of oyster beds that...
Yeah, the estuary of the Hudson is a very complex water system, and it just had oysters everywhere. The kind of oysters that are found on the Atlantic coast of the United States favor sort of brackish water, not quite as salty as open sea, but not fresh water. So they like places where fresh water is running into salt water. So the estuaries of rivers is the ideal location.
And of course, that's exactly what New York Harbor is, right?
Right.
Let's talk a little bit about the evolution of commerce with respect to the oyster, because that's really what New York City is all about. And you did a little bit of conversation about the difference between New York City and Boston and the competitive streaks, that the competitive differences of each community. Would you elaborate a little bit on that?
Yeah, you know, you realize, you know, personally, as a longstanding Red Sox fan who lived in New York, I've always been aware of this certain sort of edge between New York and Boston.
Uh-huh. And it goes way back, doesn't it?
It turns out to be quite historic, yeah. And for a long time, Boston was the leading port, and New York was a considerably lesser port, but very ambitious. And they competed for port traffic, and this was a very a very competitive thing. And
And Boston was kind of this place built on the Puritan ethic, whereas New York City had an entirely different character about it.
Yeah, I mean, Boston was Boston, and New York was New York way back, you know, and people would go, Bostonians would go to New York, and they'd say, you know, this place is great, you know, they don't close everything up for the Sabbath, and, you know, you can drink all you want here, and, you know, it was known for a lot of prostitution, and, a lot of the famous pirates settled in New York because, you know, the Boston would look askance at selling stolen goods from pirates, but New Yorkers didn't take anything of it. So they do great businesses in New York, and it was kind of a wide open place. And in fact, the British army in British colonial days was based in New York, and you know, it was the place they wanted to be. They didn't, you know,
they didn't want to hang around those Puritans in Boston. They
right. They didn't, you know, soldiers didn't want to be billeted around a bunch of Puritans. They wanted to be in New York having a good time.
Take you to the big oyster. Yeah. So tell us a little bit about the evolution of the oyster trade then. I mean, the oysters having such a great resource to mine.
Yeah. I mean,
that was essentially free for the picking for anybody.
Yeah, and originally, you know, people would just go and pick them. You know, you want some oysters for dinner, or if you want a snack or something, you just go to the water's edge and pick them. And then as the population grew, you know, a business was built on supplying them, and it became bigger and bigger. And as New York grew as a port, started doing more business with the Caribbean. They started pickling oysters and sending them down to the Caribbean for slave food. Again, competing with Boston that was sending salt cod for slave food. You know, at every step that New York grew as a port, the oyster business grew. So the first steamships up the Hudson, which you know, it's one of these things that everybody gets wrong in history, that Robert Fulton did not invent the steam engine. He did not even invent the steam ship. What he did was he created the first commercially profitable run of a steamship.
And that was
from New York to Albany.
There you go.
And that meant that upstate New York could buy New York City oysters, and that became a big business. And then came the Erie Canal.
And the opening of the Great American West.
That's right. You know, then you were linked to the New York City was linked to the Great Lakes, and then they built other canals, like the Ohio Canal, which linked the Great Lakes to the Ohio River, which meant it was linked to the Mississippi, and you had this huge interconnected waterway, which New York City was now connected to. And started shipping oysters all over America. And then when clipper ships started picking up the time, transatlantic crossing, New York oysters started being sold in Europe.
How did they ship oysters clear across the ocean that they would get their line?
Well, you know, one of the things that I didn't really understand before I started researching this book is that, you know, we tend to think of oysters as a very delicate product, and they're not. They have very thick shells, and the
just
bottom...
Just like New Yorkers, right?
Right. And the bottom shell is cup-shaped, so that if you stack them, you always stack them with that cup-shaped shell on the bottom so that the liquid stays in. And if you keep them in a reasonably cool place, they'll last a few weeks.
So what is that liquid? Or
it's actually oyster blood.
Mm-hmm. And so when you eat a raw oyster, you're supposed to take that liquor with it, right?
Yeah, because it's very oystery.
Right.
But yeah, you're eating you're eating a live animal with the heartbeat still pumping. And
so they're so sturdy and so strong that they're able to survive those clipper ship trips across the Atlantic.
Right, and railroad trips to places like Denver and San Francisco.
And what a treat they must have been in the heart of the Great Plains, you know, to get live oysters from New York City.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's some record of Abraham Lincoln as a young politician in Springfield, Illinois, throwing some sort of reception with this huge, huge quantity of New York oysters.
Buying votes.
Right.
You know, one of the things that you talked about that kind of struck a chord with me was the oyster beds and how when oysters find a favorable place, they kind of just really pile on each other. And the weak oysters become the anchors for the strong oysters. And the
right.
weaker oysters kind of die in their shell because they get smothered by the larger oysters on the outside of them. And you know, Mark, it kind of reminded me of living in New York City.
Yes.
I just wondered if you ever made that connection. I mean, if you ever thought of that, too, the way oysters pile on in a favorable location.
And you get less and less space all the time.
Less and less space all the time. And, and
right.
you know, just thinking of the island of Manhattan, it was just such a paradise. And then people just kept piling on and piling on and piling on. And
right.
there you
have
it.
One of the things about oysters that always struck me as very much New York was that it was one of the few foods I've ever run into that went through all socioeconomic classes and was eaten in the same ways by all socioeconomic classes. So that, you know, you could go on a street corner in the slum and eat oysters, you know, either raw or grilled or an oyster stew or an oyster fricassee. Those were, you know, some of the popular ways mm-hmm. of eating oysters. And then you could go that night to one of the leading restaurants like Delmonico's where they were having a banquet to receive the President of the United States or some European head of state, and you would get the same oyster served in the same way.
Boy, you know, that was a wonderful story you told about the development of Delmonico's, and I think I'd like to pick that up when we get back from the break. Folks, Michael Olson here. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. We're talking about the history of New York City, but not only the history of New York City, but how that history was shaped by the oyster. And we've got the oyster guy with us today, Mark Kolanski, who is the author of The Big Oyster, and everything you wanted to know about history on the half shell inside that book. It's delicious, just kind of like eating a raw oyster. You just open it up and slug it down and have some fun with it. We will be right back after these messages, so do stay tuned. Welcome back, folks. We're talking about The Big Oyster, and that, of course, is New York City. We've got Mark Kolanski, author of The Big Oyster. Mark, how come it became The Big Apple instead of The Big Oyster?
Well, The Big Apple was a jazz musician term. And unfortunately, by the jazz age, it was just about all over for the oyster.
All over for the oyster, yeah. Okay, so that...
up until the 1920s, New York was completely associated with oysters. And if somebody said, "I'm going to New York," everybody would say, "Oh, wow, you're going to eat some great oysters."
It's the oyster capital of the world. And not only that, it's hard to comprehend how big of a oyster capital of the world it was until you realize that New York Harbor was, what, about one-half the world's oyster?
Yeah, the biologists estimate that the wild, before they even started planting them, when Europeans first came and it was just full of wild oyster beds, that it was about half of the oysters in the world.
Well, Mark, how long did those oyster beds in the natural state last before they kind of played out and people had to start farming them?
By the early 19th century, they were showing signs of depletion. Actually, they were showing signs of depletion in the 18th century. By the early 19th century, it was getting pretty serious. And by the 1820s, 1830s, they started feeding beds with Chesapeake seeds.
And what do you mean seeds?
Seeds are
baby
oysters.
Baby oysters, yeah.
About the size of a fingernail.
So they propagate oyster seedlings, as it were, or baby oysters, in more favorable waters and then bring them in and plant them in these oyster beds, correct?
Right.
And pretty much the same way they do it today. But in those days, in the 18th, 19th century, they were shipping a huge, huge quantity of oysters all over the world. Just staggering the amount of oysters that they were shipping. And, of course, this oyster industry was a labor-intensive industry, correct? It was providing a lot of jobs for a lot of people?
It was. Not very well-paying jobs, but a lot of it. It was very striking that, you know, the price of oysters in New York City from the time of the American Revolution till the time the last beds were closed in the 1920s barely moved. They were just always really cheap.
So they were really
cheap.
You
could get all you could eat for 6 cents.
Cheap food for everybody then.
Yeah.
And
when they first, a German immigrant invented a steam table on wheels that you could take around and sell hot dogs. And they went to Coney Island, and they couldn't compete because for the price of a hot dog, you could get a plate with a dozen oysters. I mean, wouldn't you rather have a dozen oysters than a hot dog?
Yes. Having seen what goes in hot dogs, I'd much rather go for the oysters. Absolutely. Well, you know, we were talking a little bit about Delmonico's, and tell us a little bit about the significance of Delmonico's to New York culture and how the oyster fit into that development.
Yeah, well, a couple of things happened that made New Yorkers start to realize that they didn't have much in the way of restaurants. The first was the opening of the Erie Canal. And they wanted to celebrate, and they really had nothing but a bunch of oyster places. And then, you know, what always makes Americans self-conscious about the restaurant, an important Frenchman showed up. In this case, the
Heapings
Lafayette.
With heapings of Yankee guilt, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So Lafayette showed up, his first return since the Revolution, about 1825. Hoping to have a quiet trip, and everybody wanted to fet him everywhere. But they were embarrassed. They didn't, you know, they didn't have any place worthy of a Frenchman.
You can have oysters, or you can have oysters, and usually you can have
That's
oysters
right.
on the street, right?
Right. And so these Swiss brothers decided there was a real opportunity. One of them had been a wine merchant, and they decided there was a real opportunity, and they opened Delmonico's, a French-style restaurant, originally a very simple restaurant, and it got more and more elaborate. And Delmonico's really set the tone for upper-class dining in Manhattan into the 20th century. There's so many dishes that come from Delmonico's, you know, that Delmonico's steak, which is you know, a sirloin and a sort of a short fillet, and you know, Delmonico's potatoes, and lobster Newburg, which was named after a guy named Wenberg, who then got in a fight with the management. They said, "Ah, well, we're not going to name this dish after him anymore." So they switched the letters around to Newburg instead of Wenberg.
Uh-huh. And, of course, the most famous Delmonico's invention of all, which was the business lunch, right?
Right, right. Also, it was the first restaurant New Yorkers had ever seen where there was a woman at the cash register. She actually was the wife of one of the owners.
Let a woman handle the bucks.
Right.
Wow.
Right. And, you know, it was Delmonico's always tried to be a sort of a progressive place. Women were not allowed unescorted in New York restaurants in the 19th century, but Delmonico's would allow women to have lunches there, which was considered, you know, a very progressive thing at the time. And they formed a women's club that, in fact, really was progressive, but was very important in the women's suffrage movement.
Let's look back to the Civil War. And it's hard to imagine the impact the Civil War had on New York City, but it had a big one, didn't it?
Yeah, a huge impact. It was very good for the oyster people, though, because the two important places for the oyster business in the United States were New York and Chesapeake Bay. And the first thing the Union did at the outbreak of the Civil War was throw a naval blockade on all of the South, and they didn't allow oyster boats to operate in the Chesapeake anymore. So
you cut off half the competition, right?
Right, right. So New York City had a complete monopoly. And among others, soldiers ate a lot of oysters. I was looking at this, and amazingly, the Quartermaster General in 1859, the last year before, you know, it broke up into a Union and a Confederate Army, the last year that there was one whole U.S. Army, they spent more money on procuring oysters than on procuring beef.
Wow. Well, it was probably cheaper, right? I mean, they used oysters for feeding slaves, so why not soldiers?
Right, and the nice thing about oysters is that they always, no matter how cheap they were, they always sort of had this kind of cachet of a luxury.
Oh, and an aphrodisiac.
And not to mention an aphrodisiac, yeah, which is why, you know, they had these oyster cellars. New York was famous for oyster cellars with a C, which were these basement places where, they had kind of plush carpeting and velvet mm-hmm. wallpaper.
Red lights?
Red light, yes. They were marked by red lights in the front. And, you know, they had these women and oysters.
And the two have gone together forever, right?
Yeah, it goes way back.
Way back.
So, well, supposedly, Roman orgies always served oysters, and Casanova ate oysters, and according to Byron, Don Juan ate oysters.
And we eat oysters, too. Folks, this is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here with the Big Oyster, the man himself, Mark Kurlansky, author of The Big Oyster, and you. Not able to take your phone calls today because this is a recorded program, but we are having fun anyway. And when we get back, we're going to eat lots more oysters. We're going to talk about the oyster boom, the oyster bust, and what happened to the oysters in New York Harbor. You stay tuned.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. MetroFarm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. MetroFarm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. MetroFarm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of MetroFarm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Welcome back, folks. This is the Food Chain. Hey, we're talking about New York City and the history of New York City as defined by the oyster. When Europeans first stumbled onto New York, to Manhattan Island, they found an oyster paradise, and it was an oyster paradise for, gosh, how long, Mark? A couple hundred years there.
Well, I mean, you know, when the Europeans first came and found these huge piles of oyster shells, and some of them lasted into the 20th century and 21st, there's still some around. And the oldest ones have been carbon dated to almost 7,000 BC.
Ooh, a lot of oysters over a long, 7,000 BC.
Yeah.
9,000 years, right?
Right.
Wow. And I guess, you know, it's really difficult when you see Manhattan today to visualize the Garden of Eden paradise that it must have been when the Europeans first discovered it. But
although, you know, when you live here, I mean, I've always noticed when there are vacant lots in Manhattan
mm-hmm.
in the summertime, they so quickly get overgrown, you know, by mid-July it looks like a tropical rainforest.
Wow.
And you know, nature, when it's given a chance here, is really quite a power.
Well, let's go back to the oyster here, 1880s to 1910. You talk about history's greatest oyster boom. What was that, Mark?
Well, You know, this was something, it was in New York, but it was also, you know, in Paris and in London. And people just were eating incredible quantities. I mean, none of this, you know, half dozen oysters before dinner. You know, how about three dozen or six dozen?
It was huge quantities. A genuine orgy of oyster eating, right? People were
And you see this in 19th century oyster recipes. You know, they begin by saying, you know, take 500 oysters and put them in a pot.
500 oysters?
Yeah, I mean, they talk about huge quantities. They had these restaurants that were called lobster palaces. So you wouldn't call them oyster palaces because that would have been an oxymoron because oysters were so cheap.
Right.
People would go there. Out-of-town businessmen would go. You know, that's what you do. You go to New York, you eat oysters. They go to these palaces and they eat, you know, dozens and dozens and dozens of oysters and then have a huge meal afterwards.
And then the oysters were always the appetizers. Oysters were never the mainstay of a meal, were they?
Well, for poor people.
When you were hungry and had to eat, there were
oysters
everywhere.
But there were people in New York in the 18th and 19th century who rarely ate anything but oysters and bread.
Because the oysters were relatively free.
Bread
was cheap.
Yeah, the other great export product of New York was wheat.
With wheat, yeah.
I suspect that those people got pretty tired of oysters.
Because that's what you had to eat every day.
Right. But in the 19th century, it was said that the average New York family ate two oyster meals a week, one of which was on Sunday.
Uh-huh. And it's also fair to say that oysters were literally the foundation upon which New York City was built, and were part of that foundation for hundreds of years. And then what happened? You know, you talk a little bit about the oyster panic of 1854, which caught my attention. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, that was interesting because, you know, you have to remember that until the 1880s and 1890s, medical science did not really understand much about what caused diseases like typhoid and cholera. And one of the leading theories was that it was caused by immigrants. Because, you know, don't immigrants cause everything bad?
You don't hear that today.
just
kidding, I guess. Of course you don't.
These epidemics would often start in slums, which had immigrants because they, you know, had the worst sanitation.
Mm-hmm.
This one epidemic in the early 1850s hit the upper class first, and a number of very prominent New York citizens died of cholera. And this was a huge shock. So they started thinking, well, maybe it's not the immigrants. Maybe it's not poverty at all. What could it be? You know, maybe it's the oysters. And there was this oyster panic for a while, and people wouldn't touch oysters. And, the epidemic passed, and then this was kind of forgotten about. And they moved on. But actually, they were right.
Yeah, it was the oysters.
Yeah, I mean, in the 1890s, when, you know, in the mid 19th century, Louis Pasteur understood that germs cause disease, and everybody thought this was a pretty interesting but unproven theory. It was called the germ theory.
Right.
You know, what do you think of the germ theory? Well, I don't know. You know, maybe. Who knows? And then in the 1880s and 1890s, this was all irrefutably proven. And not only that, but they developed the technology so that they could go to a place that was having an epidemic and actually identify the source of the epidemic.
And then we're going to have to take a quick break, but when we come back, we're going to talk about what turned out to be the cause of the epidemic and what happened to all the oysters in New York Harbor? Folks, this is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here with the big oyster guy himself, Mark Kalansky. Do stay tuned. The Big Oyster, New York City. They call it the Big Apple, but it really should be called the Big Oyster because that's what it was built on. Michael Olson here. This is the Food Chain. We're talking with Mark Kalansky, the author of The Big Oyster, and we're talking about New York City. When we went to break, we were talking about the oyster panic of 1854 and what caused that panic. Well, people blamed it on oysters. And lo and behold, there was something to that thought. Mike? Mark?
Well, you know, it doesn't come as any big surprise to us today, but it did come to come as somewhat of a surprise to New Yorkers when it turned out that centuries of dumping raw sewage on oyster beds was not healthy. When once they had this ability to identify the cause of these epidemics, they got traced almost every time to shell beds. Oysters ingest water, and they're kind of like a filter,
right.
Especially if you eat them raw. So they started closing down the shell beds, and eventually they were all closed down because of the of disease. But they were still there, and oysters could still live. Then in the 1960s and 70s, the water got so bad that they couldn't even live. I mean, you know, some places like the Gowanus Canal and the Passaic River would give out these acid fumes that were so strong they would peel the paint off the building. People who lived near waterways kept their windows shut because it smelled so bad.
And nothing could live in those waters, and especially not oysters, right?
Right. But the good news is that it's been cleaned up. And oysters can now live in New York water, and environmentalists are trying to replant beds. However, you still can't eat New York oysters because they're full of PCBs and heavy metals, which still have to be cleaned up. So, you know, we still have a ways to go, but a lot of progress was made because in the 1970s, the EPA was created, and the Clean Water Act, which mandated cleaning up the water, and these things caused tremendous progress to be made. Today, we're not really making any progress. And, you know, I think people want to continue seeing things get better. Yeah, we've gotten kind of complacent because for 30 years now, things have been getting better. But
right.
If you want them to continue to get better, I think you're going to have to go back to fighting for it.
Mark, any oysters left in New York? Do you still find them on the street? Do you have to go to fancy restaurants to get them now?
Well, I think oysters are quite popular now, more popular than they were 10 or 15 years
but
ago.
But certainly more expensive, right?
But they've become a luxury thing.
Yeah.
They're quite expensive, and you're not going to see poor people in slums eating them anymore.
And that's the sad story. Folks, this has been The Food Chain. Michael Olson here with Mark Kalansky, author of The Big Oyster. Hey, pick up a copy and open it up and have some oyster on the half shell. You'll love it. Thank you so much, Mark, for joining us.
Nice talking to you.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.